Don't you know? We're talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know? We're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines.
Come on, what we're looking at today, it looks like J.P. Morgan is facing a rather large settlement with the U.S. government, a settlement that may not be a complete settlement. In fact, there's some stipulations that are apparently being worked out. Plus, there's also some news today coming from the Times that the Madoff case might be coming back to haunt Morgan as well. We'll look at both of those stories. Bill has a couple of interesting little quotational-type stories about the national debt and what the former candidate Barack Obama said before he became president about the debt. We're also, of course, going to look at the Obamacare and the application, what do we call it, tragedy, mistake, screw-up, ongoing mess, whatever you want to call it. And if we can get to it, we'll talk about a couple of libertarian solutions. But we're going to start off the hour with the show that goes on forever. It's basically what we might call the ghost of Edward Snowden past, present, and future, otherwise known as Liberty. Oh, no, did I say that? Sorry. But apparently news coming out of Europe that both France and Germany are a bit miffed at the United States because of more Snowden revelations that suggest that, well, we're actually tapping the lines of their national leaders. That's a little bit annoying for them and a little bit embarrassing for the NSA, Bill.
Yeah, it's Obama called up Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, and said, well, you know, we're not going to listen to any of your phone conversations. We're not going to tap your phone. And we're not doing it now. We're not going to do it in the future. She said, what about the past? Well, but the way this happened was it was not directly from the NSA Snowden operations. What happened was they sent out a diplomatic, top secret, confidential message to all their diplomatic personnel, saying send to the NSA all of your email lists, contact information, fax numbers, telephone numbers for all diplomatic contacts anywhere in the world. And so they collected everything and put them into their NSA, you know, system with, I assume, some kind of executive privilege so that they could actually, you know, connect to, monitor the metadata and theoretically at least tap some of their phones. Now, this was actually a part of another NSA program, which was to steal email address books. And, you know, simultaneously to this, or even prior to it, they were in a single day last year, according to a Snowden document, collecting 250 million different email addresses via all of the social websites, Yahoo, Hotmail, Facebook, Gmail and other providers, and putting them into their system as a daily intake. So they're not just using telephone data anymore. They're now taking information from email address lists and other sources without the users actually being aware of it.
But of course, they're not actually using that data. That's what they keep telling us all along, right? So we believe them.
Well, here's the thing is that, number one, they collect all this information and they store it. Now, what they say is that that's perfectly legal. We can grab all this stuff and store it. But if we target somebody, then we have to comply with the FISA regulations and the electronic surveillance regulations that Congress has passed. Target means that they actually type in somebody's number and go out and access all of the data they have already stored and put it into a separate file for an investigation.
Right. Now, and since they promised us that they always obey the law, therefore we know that they haven't done that, right?
Well, we know that they have not done any of it intentionally. There's an intentionally work. And it's funny because it's in the law. It explicitly says in the law that the NSA shall not intentionally gather information on any U.S. person. That means a person in the U.S. It doesn't mean U.S. citizens. It might be somewhere else in the world. And, of course, it puts almost no restrictions whatever on gathering foreign information. So the NSA, under U.S. law, can do all of this stuff, and some of it has to be reviewed by FISA, the FISA court. But they cannot target any particular U.S. person intentionally. They can do it accidentally. It might be a result of a bounce between two or three or four or five different phone numbers. But this tapping the ambassador's telephones and so on also came about 2 weeks ago because there was an international conference, a G8 conference, and they actually wiretapped all of the communications facilities, every computer that was in the hotel where the diplomats were. And they connected with, they stole all the diplomatic communications that occurred by the people that attended this G8 conference. And that got a lot of people upset. So they're not idle. They're not just sitting on their hands, and they're not, hunching back and cringing and worrying about the law changing or people getting really upset about this. They're proceeding onward and doing their thing.
And, of course, the Angela Merkels of the world are absolutely in love with this concept, as Angela made perfectly clear. She thought this was the most wonderful idea that had ever come out of the United States.
as did the chancellors, chairmen, presidents, and so on of half a dozen other countries that all of a sudden discovered, either through Snowden documents or whatever it was, that either the NSA or the British intelligence, I can't remember what their initials are, GCHQ or something like that, were basically gathering up, scooping up, what do they call it, hoovering, that's what the British call it, hoovering up all the data that was going across any kind of international communication lines. And so that there is, we don't hear about in the U.S., but in places like Bolivia and Venezuela and so on and so forth, they're up in arms because they're even talking about setting up their own internets without going through U.S. servers because they're so upset with the amount of spying that's been done on their citizens, but also their government employees and diplomats. So it's not just Germany or just France or just Britain.
And yet there's a problem. I mean, I've thought about this whole concept of setting up alternative internets, but there is a very significant problem with it, no matter how you go about doing it. And that is the U.S. is still the number one market in the world. If you set up an internet that doesn't include the U.S., you are basically excluding your public from interacting business-wise with the largest market in the world. And by the largest population, I mean the largest dollar volume.
Yeah. No, I think what they're talking about is an intranet, which is a little bit different than the internet, specifically for government and diplomatic operations. So they're basically setting up their own private network that functions just exactly the same way the internet does, except it's only for designated connections. In other words, it doesn't go through the normal internet packet switching things. It's all a private system. So I think that's what they're looking at as an alternative. It doesn't protect their citizens, but at least it protects their government workers, I guess. So.
And I'm not even sure that works because, I mean, it's not like telephone tapping is old technology that doesn't work anymore.
No, that's true. That's true. So, well, the interesting aspect of this is the rhetoric comes from Obama. He says, we're spying on everybody everywhere in the world, and that's what every country does. Well, that's Angela Merkel got really peeved off. She says, we're supposed to be allies. We're supposed to be friends. You don't go speeping in our underwear, and checking out everything in, our communications and diplomacy and government policies without us being aware of it. That's not good diplomacy. Duh.
I have to wonder, though. I mean, Merkel and Holland and everybody who was making so much noise about this, I wonder how much of the noise they were making was for the public benefit, because I can't believe for a second that they didn't think that this was going on. I mean, I really can't believe it.
Yeah, I mean, there may be something to that. But in terms of, here's the thing. It's a geographic thing. All communications between the U.S. and Germany go through Britain, because Britain is a landing point for all of the underwater, sea cables, and for most of the satellite communications. So all the communications from Germany go through Britain if they're going anywhere to the Americas, north or south. So in part, they may have suspected that the British, you know, were, you know, listening in on something, you know, here, there, and everywhere, because they have much less strict regulations on their intelligence agency. But a lot of them just assumed that the laws that the Congress had passed were being, you know, applied rigorously, and that nobody was being listened to or tapped or traced or whatever it was without the approval of the FISA court. And then the only reason why the FISA court exists is because it's specifically aimed at terrorists. Well, that implies that the Chancellor of Germany is a terrorist when you put them on the list and you start monitoring their transactions and phone calls. Yeah. So that's the diplomatic insult that they're upset.
And that's why I think it's purely for public consumption, because, I mean, I can't remember what the name of it is, but the secret cabal of five countries that you referred to, their CIA friend, ex-CIA friend Charles Faddis, couldn't confirm exists, Gang of Five or whatever it was. I can't remember what it's called. But clearly the data sharing that they're doing strongly suggests to the leaders of those countries and to the governments of those countries that this kind of data collection is going on. So,
yeah,
how do you collect that data and then pretend that it's not happening? I can see you can do that is if you're doing it as a public persona.
No. But here, it was called the Five Eyes.
The Five Eyes.
Eyes like eyeball. Okay.
Yeah.
And it did not include France or Germany or Italy or any of the other European countries. It included the U.S., Britain, Canada, Australia and New Zealand.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you're right. It didn't include any of the continental Europeans.
Yeah, so they weren't in on the deal.
Well, that's embarrassing.
Well, just knowing that the Five Eyes exist and they aren't one of them, that's bound to piss off any diplomat.
Yes, it's so much fun being the NSA in the United States these days. And I'm sure that they have even more fun than we know about so far. But
there's an incidental
you find out more and more.
Yeah, there's an incidental story of the NSA thing, because it relates to mostly to Snowden. And apparently the documents are now getting out to other medias, because it isn't just the Guardian in England and the Washington Times that are doing the stories. But the intriguing thing is that a billionaire has offered Glenn Greenwald, who has been the confidant for Snowden for all these releases, an opportunity to both design and fashion, operate, and contribute to an entirely new news outlet with using, you know, Greenwald's concepts about what journalism should be, and it should be, you know, an advocate and should be skeptical of any kind of government statements and should be going out there finding the facts, whether they're secret or not. So that's an interesting sideline. And as a consequence, over the past week or two, Glenn Greenwald hasn't been posting anything from Snowden. He's apparently made a deal with other newspapers and provided them with certain documents. So it may be a little slow. Of course, there's other things going on, so they don't want to, you know, release any significant news stories while the news media is totally absorbed with shutdowns and debt ceilings and Obamacare and all this crap. So it'll be a few more weeks before they put on anything substantial.
Speaking of Greenwald, did you see the interview he gave? I don't remember who he gave it to, some obscure publication, in which he referred to the Western media as a whole as being corrupt. I thought that was a fascinating adjective for him to use.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He regularly appears on a variety of different major media and minor media and Internet interviews. Democracy Now! Talks to him, or used to talk to him almost once a week. His big beef is that journalists in the United States and to some degree in Europe have become handmaidens to their governments.
Which is
true.
They
survive by pandering to everything the government wants and spinning stories the way the government wants, and he doesn't consider that journalism.
Yeah, I agree with him. It's not journalism.
Yeah, it's And they, as a consequence, they're defrauding their listeners and making a pretense of providing objective information when they're not. They're just channels for government propaganda. And he's said that multiple times.
You mentioned the debt and all that kind of good stuff. You passed along a rather interesting quote from then-Senator Barack Obama about the U.S. debt. I thought this might be a good place to bring that up since you mentioned it.
Yeah. Well, this is something that, if I can find it here. I have too many stories. I can't
find it. We got to get you a new somewhere. Program, that's all, yeah.
I need a better search program.
Do you want me to?
Obama quote on the debt. Yeah, go ahead. If you got it there, handy,
go ahead. I'll read it to you. It says, this is from Senator Barack Obama, taken March 2006. I'm not sure what the actual source of it was, but he said, the fact that we are here today to debate raising America's debt limit is a sign of leadership failure. It is a sign that the U.S. government cannot pay, my quote thing here isn't working.
Its own bills.
Its own bills. There we go. Yeah. It is a sign that we now depend on ongoing financial assistance from foreign countries to finance our government's reckless fiscal policies. Increasing America's debt weakens us domestically and internationally. Leadership means that the buck stops here. Instead, Washington is shifting the burden of bad choices today onto the backs of our children and grandchildren. America has a debt problem and a failure of leadership. Americans deserve,
better.
Deserve better. There we go.
Yeah, this was a statement back in 2006 when, of course, George Bush was president and Bush wanted to raise the debt ceiling. But it's intriguing because, and this is right out of the congressional record. I mean, this is a direct quote out of the congressional record.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Because it's the kind of thing that if Rush Limbaugh said what Obama said, you know, he would be totally lambasted by every Democrat in the world saying, oh, how irresponsible, you're opposed to raising the debt ceiling. Oh, what is this thing about debt? You know, it's a big deal. And so it's intriguing to look back.
Because Barack said it first, and he's not getting credit for it. Sorry. I just couldn't resist. Oh, by the way, you also had a quote about the sequester, or I guess some information about the sequester that was worth paying attention to. Do you have that available?
This is the sore point. Even after they came to this agreement deal, they set up a little working group to see how they could get around sequester. Because it was such a terrible idea, the worst way that the government could work, and it's totally random, and it's 5% across the board, blah 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 blah. Well, what people don't realize is that the sequester involves $44 billion in spending cuts, not cuts out of the current expenditures, but cuts out of the projected expenditures of $3.5 trillion in spending.
Now, which was an increase over the previous year by an amount significantly larger than $44 billion.
Yes. And if you look at the actual, if you chart the amount of spending versus with or without sequester, you can't even tell the difference on a chart because it's such a tiny little difference. 44 out of 3.5 trillion is nothing. They would have to multiply that sequester amount by 20 times just to balance the budget. And obviously that's not something that's on the table.
Boy, wouldn't that be fun, though. I mean, can you imagine the headlines that come out of that? Oh, my goodness. Cardiac arrest.
Yeah, as part of the grand deal, they appointed Paul Ryan from the House and rabid Socialist Democrat from the Senate to set up a committee to consider what alternatives there might be to the sequester program because they want to be able to free up some of the spending for all these different agencies that were touched very lightly by the sequester plan that came down 2 years ago or a year ago. So it's, of course, that's never ever going to report anything, and it's not, nobody's ever going to do anything because those two people would never agree on the time of day.
It's tough being a big government spender these days. I mean, it's, you know, it's just so difficult to continue with your policy, you know? Oh, well. Well, speaking of big government spending, Obamacare, of course, continues to be in the news with the announcement this past week, not so much an announcement, but perhaps acknowledgement by the president that there were some serious problems with the rollout of Obamacare, particularly through the exchanges. I thought that was quite acute of the president to notice that there was a problem. I know the Republicans felt very much the same way. In fact, they were so impressed that they called in his secretary to explain why the problem hadn't been reported in the first place.
I think it was the House. The House is having hearings today, and just the simple fact that there were 55 different contractors involved in setting up the system. There were 11 different corporations that were involved in writing the programming code for this operation, and none of them had control over how it was going to work. None of them had access to the regulations they were supposed to be implementing on the website because they haven't been written yet. And the decisions about when and how to roll out the online services was done entirely by Sebelius, Health and Human Services Secretary, who has total control of the program. Well, according to the testimony today, all these different 11 companies tested their own modules, and then they passed them on to CMS and said, here, put them together and, you know, do your own testing. And this was like a couple of months before. And so CMS put it together, and they did their testing, and they couldn't get the thing to run. It was just crashing every time because these 11 different modules were not totally accurately communicating among each other. And they weren't communicating with the half dozen different agencies, public and private, that they had to communicate to find out whether or not the person online was actually qualifying for tax credits. And so that they couldn't get the thing to work, and they knew it was going to work. But they went up to Congress and said, oh, we're making good progress. Everything's going to be on time. October 1st is our deadline. We're going to do it October 1st. 2 weeks before, they changed the specifications for the software. And they said, we're no longer going to allow people to go into the Obamacare website and find out what the rates are for the insurance. They have to first complete a login and an application specifying all their financial data, Social Security number, blah, 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 and so on and so forth. And then, after they do that, then we'll show them the prices because we can then also show them how much the government is going to pay, what the subsidy is or the tax credit is that they're going to be able to get. They didn't want to show that the rates are going to really be increasing by 50% or 100% or 200% over what they're currently paying. They wanted to show what the result was going to be after the subsidies were applied against the premiums. So they changed the entire thing 2 weeks before, and the programmer said, yeah, we did the best we could in 2 weeks to install that component and get the other components working together, and we talked to each other and ironed out bugs. And even today, that their CNN was doing a little test with a group of people that were trying to go on to the site and log in, and they couldn't do it. But none of them were able within the course of an hour show to get on the website and actually complete the enrollment.
Oh, I cannot do that. I can do better than that because I'm one of the 18 million who tried to go in just to see if they could find out, you know, what the rates were and so forth. So I tried to set up a login on Monday, and I couldn't log in. Well, I could place the order that entered my information, and then I was supposed to get the verification email. Well, the verification email hadn't shown up after an hour or two, so I called into their tech support and asked them how long should I wait for the email. And the reply was, well, there's no fixed time limit. You just have to wait till it arrives. Well, today's Thursday. It still hasn't arrived.
You're in the queue with 800,000 others.
So we're not talking about having to wait an hour or two. We're wondering about whether it's going to show up at all.
Yeah, no. I mean, the interesting thing is that they tried to hide the results. You know, the 45 states are being run by the federal government. They've said that there are 800,000 people who have enrolled, but they haven't explained what enrolled means.
Mm.
And it does not mean that they've enrolled in a health care plan. It means they've enrolled on the website like you were trying to do, and either they have or haven't received a verification or validation. But that covers just the federal ones. Now, there's also the state ones, and when they talk about enrollment, they mean different things. For example, some of them count it just if you created a login and accessed the site, you are enrolled. In other words, you have a screen name, you have a valid login, and a password. And there are other states that say, well, you're not enrolled until you actually go through, create the login, fill out the application, get confirmation, go and select a program, and then hit the button to pay for it. So
now,
every state is
reporting
something
different. I want to point out something here. I mean, you mentioned earlier how there were these various components, these 11 modules that didn't interact nicely, and nobody had actually, checked to see, were they compatible with each other.
Right.
But none of those 11 modules have anything to do with setting up an account and getting a verification email, unless I'm completely mistaken. So really all that is still a lot of noise to hide the basic fact that the Obama administration has not figured out how to deliver email through an automated server system. That's kind of a scary concept when you think
about it.
I don't think that's the
bottleneck is that when you enter in your Social Security number, they have to send that to the IRS. The IRS has to verify your income. They send that the identification number or the Social Security number to immigration to make sure you're not an illegal alien and that the Social Security number is correct. Then they send your name and address and Social Security to Experian, which is a private access point for credit card information, so that they can verify that your address is correct.
Sending a verification email. I mean, sure.
No,
okay.
But they aren't going to send out the verification until they get back all the accurate information and verify that it's correct.
Why they want to do that. But that doesn't prevent them from sending out a verification email. There's a thing called asynchronous programming. That's where you let the programming do multiple things at once. You don't have to rely on one thing to work out before you can do the rest of it. So it's not like you have to wait for all that information to check out before you send out the verification email. You can send it out before. And even if you send it out before and they verify and the information isn't back yet, well, then they just don't get full access. They get a message that says, we're still doing a check. It doesn't prevent them from sending the verification email.
They don't want to send you a verification that you are eligible for the Obamacare exchanges until they're sure that you are going to get a refund or that you are eligible for some tax credit. So that's what they decided 2 weeks before they rolled it out.
Even that doesn't make any sense because if in theory you're supposed to be able to get the insurance regardless of whether you qualify for some sort of a subsidy, that means even somebody who has to pay the full 12 grand or whatever it is per year can still order it through an exchange. Well, if you can't get into the exchange unless you qualify for a subsidy, that means they can't even order it through an exchange.
Well, you see, they can't order it through an exchange because there's all kinds. Like I say, there's 11,000 words of regulations about how this is done, and thousands of words, 300,000 words, I think it is, in the legislation itself. So, for example, you cannot be charged more for an insurance premium than, I think it's 4% of your net income. And so they really have to barrel down to find out whether or not your net income is going to equal 4%, is going to be less than the premium. Because if the premium is more than that, they're going to cut down the premium.
Yeah,
so that's another form of tax credit or subsidy or whatever you want to call it. So they have to figure out
craziness, but it is. But but ultimately, it all is a very nice way of avoiding the fact that it isn't difficult to send out a verification email. It just gives
well, you know, the technical side is they'll bring in and spend another $500 million to fix the system. I mean, it's technical interfacing and, you know, data verification.
I have to give Obama credit for that, because what he did do is he went out and hired Verizon, the most expensive mobile cell phone network in America, to come in and run the most expensive healthcare system in America. I thought that was a good match myself. I mean, you could think differently.
They'll get it fixed. I mean, this is just technical glitches. What they cannot fix is how the system actually works in the end, whether you really have a doctor, whether you can keep your insurance plan, what it's going to cost. They have no idea.
Well, now I feel a whole lot better. Hey, we're time for a break here. Let's take the break afterward. We haven't gotten to the Morgan mess, so we'll talk about that as well as whatever we can get into about Obamacare. Hey, this is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network. We'll be right back. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, Walton Bill, on this Thursday, October 24th. And J.P. Morgan Chase is back in the news. They've increased, or I should say the government increased, the amount that J.P. Morgan's going to owe the government as part of its investigation into the mortgage bond sales scandal and so forth that, among other things, helped contribute to the 2008 crisis. That deal was originally an $11 billion deal. It's now up to $13 billion. And Bloomberg reports that the tentative pact with the Justice Department not only increases the mark, but it also includes a notation at the insistence of U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder that the deal does not release the bank from potential criminal liability. This according to terms described by a person familiar with the talks who asked not to be named because they were private. Gee, I wonder why he would not want to have himself named. Quote from an analyst named Nancy Bush. She's a bank analyst who founded NAB Research and LLC, NAB Research LLC in New Jersey. She said, "To not get the waiver from criminal prosecution is not good. What we're looking for in a settlement of this size is certainty from things like the criminal prosecution of a company. The street wants certainty." Well, that kind of inverted logic leads me to say that I have to say I disagree with Ms. Bush. I mean, Ms. Bush is certainly entitled to her opinion, but I kind of like the idea that criminal prosecution is a possibility. I think probably most of America likes that idea, and if it's the street that doesn't like the idea, they're kind of out of step with the rest of the country. But that's just my view. What do you think, Bill?
I think it's all bluff. I don't think they're ever going to prosecute anybody. Beyond the lowest ranks of these various investment banks. The thing I haven't quite figured out is why they're picking on J.P. Morgan. For example, there were almost every, literally thousands, but at least a dozen major investment banks that were doing all of this, this mortgage, financial CDOs and CDIs and all this kind of stuff. All along, I mean, J.P. Morgan wasn't by any means the largest, and so I'm not exactly clear on why they're picking on J.P. Morgan. But,
well, I might be able to give you a clue on that one.
Okay.
Because it turns out that the New York Times, in an article released today entitled J.P. Morgan Faces Possible Penalty in Madoff Case, apparently just that. J.P. Morgan Chase is being considered for criminal investigation in regard to the Madoff Ponzi scheme. And so perhaps the answer to your question, Bill, is, well, they knew all along that J.P. Morgan Chase was hip deep in Madoff. They knew all along that that was going to come out at some point. So they figured, well, why don't they get out ahead of the curve, so to speak, ahead of the show, and say, oh, well, we're going to do the right thing. We're going to make it look like we're cracking down on them for 2008 as well.
No, I don't know about that. The two cases are separate cases. There's one regarding the mortgage investment bank, CDOs and CDIs and stuff like that.
The prosecutors never talk to each other.
But they haven't released the actual contents of the settlement, so it's not totally clear exactly what they're alleging that J.P. Morgan did. I don't think they did anything different. Now, the separate case is one of Madoff. In Madoff, if you read the details on it, What they are being charged with is a failure to notify the regulatory authorities that Madoff was running a Ponzi scheme. So they're going to have to prove, A, that Madoff knew, they knew that Madoff was screwing all of its clients, and that they intentionally refrained from reporting it to the authorities. But in fact, there were multiple people, and two or three that are fairly prominent, who had investigated the Madoff scheme, had sent literally dozens and dozens of letters to the regulatory authorities saying, here's what Madoff is doing. It's obviously a ripoff. He's obviously running a Ponzi scheme. You need to investigate. And they never did. So, in fact, the regulators, the bureaucrats, knew what, had all the information they needed to prosecute Madoff years and years and years before they actually got around to it. But what they're charging J.P. Morgan with is a failure to recognize something that they did not recognize, because they had all the same information was being reported by J.P. Morgan to the regulators, and not acting as an agent on behalf of the regulators by finding out what every single one of their clients was doing and whether they were on the up and up. Now, that's not something you normally, put the responsibility to, conduct criminal investigations into all of their investors to find out which ones are trying to screw their customers or trying to screw the federal government or the IRS. I mean, that's not a normal obligation that falls onto the shoulders of the banks themselves. So it's a little bit odd what the charges are actually going to be.
Well, perhaps it's odd. I also would point out that there's a strong Goldman Sachs presence in the government. There may be a little bit of fraternal squabbling going on there. Perhaps this is a little payback for something. Who knows?
But why isn't Goldman Sachs or EIG or Bank of America being prosecuted?
I mean, with the strong Goldman Sachs presence within the government, what I'm suggesting is if there is this little rivalry thing going on, then the Goldman Sachs people are making sure that J.P. Morgan Chase gets the blame.
That's possible. That was my point. I haven't quite figured out exactly why J.P. Morgan is getting the sharp end of the stick and a half dozen other bankers are not.
I think the big clue here is that we've got two separate cases. I mean, and you went out of your way to make it clear they're separate cases, but I don't believe that for a second. I think they're related,
I think they're related politically. I think it's the administration, the Justice Department, whoever it was, sat down and said, who can we make an example of here? Who can we put on the ropes so that people don't scream and complain that we haven't prosecuted any of these terrible people? And they said, let's do J.P. Morgan. Oh, okay, what do we got on them? And that's rather than going to Bank of America or anybody else. I mean, there's a dozen different major investment banks who were doing exactly the same thing Morgan was doing. And whether or not Madoff was only $10 or $20 billion that he skimmed off. I mean, that's small potatoes for an investment bank.
Oh yeah, for an investment bank.
I agree. It's probably a political choice.
But if it is a political choice, and this is where it gets really interesting, if also it's true that J.P. Morgan Chase is the investment bank that is responsible for doing the U.S. government's laundry when it comes to, repressing commodity prices and so forth. In a sense, the government, from a political perspective, is kind of playing Russian roulette, because if they get J.P. Morgan Chase pissed off enough, they may just lose their money launderer.
Well, here's another aspect of it. J.P. Morgan and all the other investment bankers depended upon three companies to decide whether or not these were legitimate investments they were creating. And they sent off messages, here's the program we want to do, to the three credit agencies, S&P, Fitch's, Standard & Poor's. And those were the three that were certified by the government as being totally authoritative in terms of what was a reasonable risk and what was a proper transaction. And they all signed off on all of these deals. And all of those deals contained this advice from these credit rating agencies, and that all went to the regulators. And the regulators never made a peep. So it's the what you probably will never hear is that any of those credit agencies are being prosecuted for misrepresenting the investments that were offered by these banks.
That's why I just got to wonder if the fact that J.P. Morgan Chase, as you pointed out, you wonder why they're being targeted, and I think there's some reason to agree that it's kind of a curious move, particularly considering the role that Morgan Chase plays in terms of doing the bidding of the Federal Reserve. When you tie all that together, it makes you wonder, is it truly a political thing? And if it's political, does it suggest that there's a kind of a war going on, a behind-the-scenes war going on at the highest levels played out through government channels, but by, I don't know, whoever the factions are. They're those faceless bankers that, you know, we always make fun of, but we don't really know who they are other than who the public faces are of the major banks. I just have this suspicion. I can't prove any of this, but I just have this suspicion that this is part of an ongoing struggle to see who can be left holding the bag. And it's not even clear to me what the bag's purpose is, but it sounds like this is all about a power struggle.
Yeah, well, it's a power struggle because the political reality is they have to find a scapegoat. They have to find somebody to blame other than politicians, other than the bureaucrats, other than the credit agencies that was responsible for this recession we've been in for the past 3 years now. And so what they're trying to do is trying to take the blame off of everybody that set all the rules and we're supposed to be regulating, it's supposed to be supervising and overseeing all these financial institutions, take the burden off them and satisfy the people that are saying, hey, where are the prosecutions?
The only people saying that are people in the public, little guys.
Yeah.
The major media aren't saying it. The politicians, the Republicans are saying it.
Well, no, but the Democrats are sensitive to their constituency, which is basically the little guy, who's saying, hey, you know, I'm getting screwed. I lost my job and so on and so forth because of all these shenanigans. How come the big guys in the banks aren't being prosecuted? And I'm sure the Democrats are under just as much political pressure to find a scapegoat as the Republicans are.
So you're suggesting that this is creating fodder for the 2014 and 2016 election campaigns?
Duh. Of course.
I think I've just been called a moron.
No, you stated the obvious. That's all. Yeah, I mean, that's what politics is. It's all about the next election, which also is rather humorous. Because everybody knows it's election next year, even the dates for implementing Obamacare and when these exchanges are supposed to allow people to get insurance policies have been changing almost on a weekly basis. At first, there was a deadline of, I think it was December 15th, that you had to, you know, go on to the exchange and buy your insurance in order for it to go into effect January 1st, because the IRS has to calculate the whole thing on the basis of the standard calendar year, which is the way most people file their returns. So at first, it was, you know, we're open October 1st, and we got an open enrollment period from October 1st to December 15th. You got lots of time to get your application in and get approved for your new insurance. Well, they said, wait a second, that ain't going to happen. Let's readjust this. Let's move the deadline ahead to February 15th. And as long as they get on by February 15th, you know, we'll just excuse them that first month and a half and, you know, give them the credit anyway for a full year. And they said, no, we can't do that. The open enrollment period has to be by quarters according to the law, so it's got to be January, February, and March. So the deadline has to be March 31st. Oh, okay, that sounds much better. We'll give them to March 31st. Well, is March 31st the deadline for enrolling, or is the deadline for actually buying the insurance policy, or just becoming enrolled and verified as eligible for the insurance policy? oh, well, we're not sure about that. I mean, we'll give the IRS 2 weeks to figure that out.
Well, they may need more than that. Because one of the fallouts from the government shutdown was that 90% of the IRS employees were laid off.
I don't think it was 90%.
Yeah, it was. That's what the news reports were telling.
90% of the enforcement division, the fraud and review division, not the IRS.
Well, according to the report I saw, it was 90% of the IRS. Now, I could be wrong, but that's what I saw. But if they had that much of their force laid off, now they got to bring them all back on. That means they're quite a bit behind schedule as it is. And, you know, I could see why they'd want to have at least till March just so they can get their own house in order.
Let alone another little sideline. I mean, the IRS still has to figure out what the regulations are. And the regulations haven't been written yet. Yeah, we talked last week about these 11 million words of regulations that have been issued by the Housing and Health and Human Services Department, but they aren't done. They've got another 11 million words to write in order to implement the various provisions of the law. Now, the amusing thing in terms of the IRS has to know what the law is before it can implement it. But the amusing thing is that there's only one organization in the world that understands the U.S. tax code for personal income tax. And it is such a complex system, and computerizing is so complicated that even the Treasury Secretary of the U.S. government goes to this organization to do his taxes, and that is called TurboTax. The Treasury Secretary does his own income tax return with TurboTax because they are the only ones that have been able to hire enough lawyers and programmers to actually implement the law as it exists. Now, I don't know what's going to happen to TurboTax because they aren't actually going to have to process any of these Obamacare credits until 2015, April 15th. Because you aren't going to get those credits until you actually file a return. So they've got a little while to figure it out, and hopefully by then Health and Human Services will have written all the regulations so they can actually put it into the code.
You realize, of course, that you're suggesting that Intuit actually runs the world.
It does. Intuit runs the entire Treasury Department, IRS, and if it weren't for them, nobody would be able to file a return.
Go buy your stock now, folks. You heard it here first. Oh, my goodness.
I've been using TurboTax for the past 10 years. It's the only thing that is easy enough to use and is comprehensive enough to cover almost everything under the sun. Hundreds of different forms, hundreds of different requirements, you know, cross-referencing this document to that document and so on and so forth. And it's always been, you know, they've always done a fabulous job of doing a good user interface. But behind all that is literally millions of bits of code that actually interpret what the IRS law says. And this is only about income tax, personal income tax. They have a totally separate product that's much more expensive for business purposes. And I don't know whether they do corporate tax returns or not, but it isn't the IRS that's figuring out these things. They're probably sitting down with TurboTax to figure out whether you did it right or wrong.
It isn't just Intuit, by the way. TurboTax isn't the only tax prep program out there that has managed to get all the government IRS regulations into place. I mean, there's H&R Block with their tax, I can't think what it's called, and there's a couple of those like that, too. So they're not the only one.
But. Well, the reason I mentioned TurboTax is because Rubin, I think, is when he was Treasury Secretary, was actually asked, you know, who does your taxes? Do you do your own taxes? He says, yeah, I do my own taxes. Oh, how do you do them? Oh, I use TurboTax.
Mm-hmm.
I can just imagine the Treasury Secretary sitting down with 50,000 pages of IRS regulations and actually doing his own return manually with a calculator.
Yeah, that has kind of like a far side look to it, doesn't it, you know? You just kind of see that one. Well, we got about 5 minutes left here. We got about 10 more articles. I don't think we're going to be able to do them all. Should we go with something funny or shall we go with something a little bit more libertarian? We haven't done anything libertarian for a while. Okay. What do you think?
Yeah, let's
look at the libertarian thing, because the Libertarian Party is only one part of libertarian philosophy, but it is one of the third parties. And there's been a number of calls this past week for a third party. In fact, I think it was even a poll that suggested that a majority felt that way. What are the details on that? Do you know?
The sentiments about libertarian ideology have been changing quite a bit just in the past 2 or 3 years. The word is becoming fairly well recognized. I mean, 4 or 5 years ago, people didn't even know what it meant. I mean, something like 6% of the population knew what libertarian meant. Now it's up in the 40s. The popularity among independents, that is people who are not registered Republicans or Democrats, is much, much higher than it is among the partisan voters. But overall, when they do surveys and they ask people two simple questions, one, do you think the government should be more or less involved in economic transactions? And should they be less or more involved in individual liberty choices? And almost 70% of the population agrees with the libertarian position on those two broad aspects. So it's becoming a more popular term. It's becoming more common in the media. There are a number of shows that take a decidedly libertarian viewpoint on the issue. And that has turned into a question of whether or not the Libertarian Party can actually get off its haunches and flat on its back that it's been for the past 30 years and actually become a true alternative to the Republicans and Democrats.
Well, I don't think it can.
I don't think it can either.
No.
And so the conversation turns to, well, how do you create a third party that people might prefer to the Democrats or Republicans that would appeal to independents? And what it turns out is that, in fact, the only common thread among the independents that constitutes the majority of the independents are the libertarian threads. I mean, the libertarian general philosophy is more common among the independents than it is among Republicans or Democrats.
Yeah, but how much of that is actually the result of it being a push poll? Because it sounds like a push poll to me.
There are two or three different polling companies that have done studies. The most popular one is Pew, but also Gallup has done them. Individual libertarian organizations are doing them in cooperation with public polling companies. And they all come down with pretty much the same percentages of people who are libertarian inclined on the major issues. And they ask them about, a dozen different issues, and then they categorize them.
Yeah, but that's a push poll by definition.
Well, it's a push poll in terms of assigning a category. I mean, people have.
Also selecting your randomly selected population based on being libertarian oriented. I mean, come on, that's push.
They survey everybody, but among the independents, the issues that appeal to independents are libertarian positions, and that's a fairly substantial percentage. It's like somewhere between 50 and 65% of independents agree with the libertarian position on political issues. The Democrats and Republicans are, flip flop on either side on half a dozen of the issues, one way or the other. The effort to establish a third party has been going on for, the last 2 or 3 decades. Pretty much under the visibility of the major media, but none of them have been able to take off. None of them have really achieved anything.
Primarily because the entire legal structure is against them.
Yeah,
and unfortunately, we can't get around that because, among other things, we're out of time.
We can't solve the problems of the world.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure as usual, Bill.
Thank you.
We'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody. Talking about everything.